It's another edition of Buy the Book here at the Nahum Segal Network. I want to thank our friends at Koren Publications. KORENPUB.com for any information regarding their incredible material that they continue to release to the general public. It's an honor here at the Nahum Segal Network to do this spot and to speak with some interesting authors and bring to you some of the latest literary works that are of interest to the Jewish world and otherwise. A very, very interesting title has come across our desk, and Zev Magen is with us via telephone as we discuss his book entitled John Lennon and the Jews, A Philosophical Rampage. It is a Toby Press release, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Zev Magen to Buy the Book. Zev, Shana Tova to you, and welcome to the Nahum Segal Network.
Shana Tova, Chatima Tova. It's an honor to be here.
Based on the biographical information that you include toward the beginning of the book, it seems like we essentially grew up at a similar time. We're likely around the same age. And I, just like you, I believe I was in high school when John Lennon was shot. And it seems that the episode, that the event, that the occurrence, that the murder of Lennon had some type of effect on your life. Am I right or wrong that this was a game changer for you growing up?
I couldn't be otherwise, because I was raised on the Beatles from day one. Probably my mother had Hey Jude playing on the womb there. So when John Lennon was assassinated, it really was a shocker for me, and I think for my entire generation. But you know, the song that we all associate with him as a solo artist, it has these words, these lyrics, and of course that tune that gets so deep inside of us and makes us feel like the Mashiach's coming tomorrow, and it's this great utopian dream of oneness for all humanity, and imagine no nations and no religions and no war, and everybody's living for today and for now and for here. And I grew up also on the idea that that was this panacea, and it just now that I look around at the world. And John said, you may say I'm a dreamer.
Right.
But it turned out he's not such a big dreamer, because unfortunately, a lot of what he was looking for is taking place around us right now. World's getting to be a much more monotonous, monochrome place. I'm standing here in a field in the middle of Hod HaSharon, Israel, and looking across at all the billboards. Most of them are in English for products that come from other places. Our project of, you know, making a special Jewish, national, unique home is under attack by globalization and by the very ideas that John was preaching there. I love the guy, and I love his music, but I hate the message.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. Because since you hate the message, your word, not mine, is it easy for you to conclude that his philosophy, therefore, as represented by that song, does not jive with Jewish philosophy or with the philosophy of being a Jewish person?
Yeah, I think it's like the diametric antithesis of everything that we stand for. We stand for difference. We stand for preference. We stand for uniqueness. We believe in love, but we believe in love that separates people out. That's the whole concept of Kiddushin. Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh comes from, holy, holy, holy is the way we usually translate it, but that's an awful translation. Kadosh doesn't mean holy. Kadosh literally, ask any Hebraicist, any Semiticist, it means different. It means special. Lekadesh mashehu, lehakdish mashehu. It just means put it aside, make it unique, and when you marry a woman or a man, what you're saying to them is, I put you aside, I make you special, I love you more than anybody else. It's not that I love everyone exactly the same. That's the opposite of kadosh. God is our God. We love him the most, more than any other God, and he loves us more than any other people. And he says it unabashedly in his bestseller over and over and over again.
Yeah,
and John's message is love everybody the same, which means, in the last analysis, love nobody.
And I think Kedoshim Tiyu, if I'm not mistaken, has some element of Hafrasha to it when it comes to analyzing it, right? So being different and having your uniqueness, so to speak, that type of thing.
That's the verse I should have quoted. Exactly.
Right.
I'm with you.
No problem. Zev Magen is with us talking about the brand new book, John Lennon and the Jews. So what's the goal of the book? In other words, if you're attributing all this to Lennon through that song, and I would assume through other songs as well, you could tell me if that's true or not. If you're attributing all this to him, and he, of course, being the philosopher of that generation, as you described somewhat to this audience, those who aren't familiar with how impactful he was on that generation of Americans and people worldwide, what was the goal of the book? Was it to disprove him? Was it to analyze it simply from a Jewish perspective, as you just did for us, you know, quickly here? What was your goal setting out?
Well, John is just a launch point, and his song is as well, because if it were only him, and if it was only his idea, we'd be in good shape. But it's the idea of philosophies from Eastern religion all the way over to Western modernism, from science to philosophy, throughout the ages, you'll find the kind of pull in the direction of entropy, of sameness. We all see it around us now. All the kids in this country, where I'm the Holy Land, I'm talking to you from here, and the kids here all listen to the same music that the kids in the States listen to, that the kids in Argentina listen to, that the kids in Ich Weiß Nicht Wer listen to. And, you know, some people may look at that and say, well, isn't that beautiful? But there, just to give you an example, there's a contest which, thank God, American listeners will not be familiar with, because it's God darn awful. But it's called the Eurovision contest. It's held once a year, and, you know, each country brings a song. Each European country brings a song. Well, time was that everyone brought a song that they sung in their own language, that emerged out of their own culture and their own, you know, specific experience and history and whatever. Today, they all sing in English, including the Israelis. You know, our song this year was, I'm a golden boy coming to enjoy, blah, blah, blah. You know, and my little two-year-old's running around singing that like it's the national anthem. And you know, the other ones are, you know, my name is Al Capone, and you're Vito Perone. I won't get on your microphone, and that's the guy from Albania.
So you're telling me Eurovision has turned basically into a cover routine.
Yeah, you could say it's there's no originality, there's no individuality, there's no national self-respect on anybody's part. And we're part of that, unfortunately.
And I remind
national. We invented nationalism.
That's
true.
You
know, we were Am Yisrael before there was a concept like that. When there were empires in the world and huge conglomerates, we said we're Am Yisrael. And you know what? We're going along with the flow that everyone is going toward, that same oneness that John Lennon was talking about. And the world is just getting boring.
And I remind everybody, by the way, that some of the great Israeli classics came from Eurovision, and as you just described, we're probably way past those days at this point.
Well, you know, we used to have Abane Biyobo Ebez, Abane Biyobo Ebebobo Tabach, which is like Ubi Dubi Hebrew, but at least it's Hebrew.
Right.
And now, you're not, it's like the Israelis, the ones who win, first it was a couple of years ago, it was half Hebrew, half English. And now it's just English.
Right.
Just give up on the project of national uniqueness, which was our mainstay throughout our people's history. Right? Be different. Kedoshim to you. And that's how you'll survive. And that's how you'll be special. And, you know, John's message it's not just his message. It's the message of everyone from Mo to, through Jesus Christ and all the way down to John himself. It's the same message. The message is we have to seek, you know, the Spice Girls, ever searching for the one. Everyone talks about it, but no one thinks about what its implications are for humanity, and they're disastrous.
Yeah, well, you're certainly making a good point, I'll tell you that much.
Well, it's not a hard point to make. Everybody lives in, you know, everybody prefers one group over another. They love their own families more than anybody else's families. It's the most natural human thing to do. It's not just a Jewish thing to do. But all of these ideologies are doing everything in their power to erase real, genuine love from the planet by getting rid of preference.
No, I understand.
And telling us that we just, you know, by the way, this is the number one attack on the existence of the state of Israel is based on the idea that we're racist because our message is we've got one family called the Jews and it's got one home and that home is ours. And if, you know, I mean, Nachum, if somebody knocked on your door and said, "Hi, my name is Bob. I'd like to join the Siegel family." he walks in, he plops down on the sofa, puts his legs up. He says, "Would you turn down the music, please? And I like my eggs over easy." Like, who would accept something like that? We have separate families, and they have their own homes, and that's a beautiful concept, and it's what makes a neighborhood world work, and it's what makes a world work and be more interesting.
Yeah.
But everybody who's anybody is chipping away at that idea. So the point of the book was, let's give some power to Jewish students on American and you know, European college campuses who are being assaulted by this, you know, oneness idea that you know, that is just undermining their connection and their affinity to their people.
Zev Magen is with us. The book is John Lennon and the Jews. Toby Press has it. You can go to the Koren Publications website. It's a Toby Press tab at the very top, and you'll see all the information regarding the book. Some, I'm sure, are curious about your own biography and whether you speak from authority when you talk about, you know, other universalistic, I hope that's the right word, points of view, especially as it comes to other religions, etc. Is this something that you explored in your life or were exposed to in your life, where you speak from a position of authority, so to speak?
Well, I can't claim to have ever been either a Christian or a Hindu or a Buddhist. But I can state that I was raised, let's say, and somewhere in between atheism, communism, and anarchism.
That's good enough.
which are, you know, all good Jewish values.
Yep.
But I was given, despite that, by my parents, a closeness, a feeling of involvement with the Jewish people and with Israel, and I bless their hearts for that every day. It's the reason that I'm talking to you from here. But you know, I mean, when you grow up as an American assimilated teenager, you experience that whole other way of looking at things. It's not necessarily a different other religions. It's more the notion that you know, there shouldn't be any religions, there shouldn't be any nations. We should all just be going to the 7-Eleven. 7-Eleven's open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Nothing should be different. Nothing should be uncomfortable, irrational. Just let's have just one kind of sameness.
Yeah.
And it's hard to fight that. It's very hard to fight that.
Do other religions essentially, and again, we know that there's some who do stand for universalism, that we understand, and we know that, and they're well known for it. But what about our cousins, for instance? What about those in Arab countries? Those are members of the Islamic tradition. Do they also abide by your suggestion that a people, that a nation should be separate and different and not necessarily go for the Lenin philosophy?
Well, actually, no, strangely enough. And we might have this image of Muslims as being fanatically anti-Western and pro-authenticity and whatnot, and that's true insofar as the Islamic religion goes. But the Islamic religion, like the Christian religion, like all the Eastern religions, and like modern Western secularism, all of them together are, you know, against the notion of separate entities based on family or based on blood. Islam is fiercely against the idea of asabiyya, of tribal connections.
Right.
You have to erase all of this. No, in Islam, there's no concept of a Palestinian. There's no concept of a Jordanian, an Egyptian, an Iraqi. Those things are anathema to Islam. And that's the reason why as we speak, many of those polities are being erased in front of our eyes by the Islamist movements like ISIS, the jihad, Islamic Jihad, or Hezbollah, Hamas, or whatever it is.
You know what's what's interesting? I remember a prominent rabbi, and this was simply as a mental exercise, not that he was suggesting that it should be otherwise, but a prominent rabbi once heard say, you know, I understand Kohanim, Levim, Yisraelim, you need, you know, people who are designated to serve in the temple, you need a Shevet Levi, et cetera, et cetera. But I never understood the Shvatim in general. That, you know, why would the Jewish people be separated into 12 Shvatim? Does the fact that we are in fact separated into 12, make your point even stronger?
Yeah, that's great. That's beautiful. I'm sorry that you didn't tell me that before I wrote the book. Because, I began the book by talking about concentric, the fact that we love in concentric circles, which is as obvious as anything to everybody. We start by loving ourselves and our families. Then we love our immediate social groups, and then we go beyond to our nation, let's say, and then all of humanity. And here's a perfect example, is the tribes. I never thought of that. You know, it's not only that we're commanded to love Jews more than, I don't know, you know, Frenchmen or Alaskans or whatever, but we're actually have an example of within the Jewish people itself. Here we have these concentric circles. Your loyalty way back when was probably to the Benjaminites or to the, Issacharians, right, more than it was to the Jewish people as a whole.
Right.
Well, actually, you can't say Jewish people because that's Yehuda.
Right.
And one of the points that I make to the best of my ability in the book is that there is no such thing as Judaism. Isms are exactly those things that erase tribal, familial, national boundaries in the name of some common faith, some common ideology. The word Judaism doesn't appear in any of our sources. There is no such thing as Yahadut. It's a modern invention by the Reform movement, actually. And what we have is Ha'am HaYehudi, the Jewish people. It's a geographic tribal designation. You say I'm a Jew, as we all know, based on simple Jewish law. It doesn't mean I believe in something in particular. It doesn't mean I follow the Torah. It doesn't mean I wrap tefillin in the morning. It doesn't mean I keep Shabbos. I'm a Jew means I am from the land of Judea, the tribe of Judea. I feel an affinity, a connection with those people. That's my historical, tribe. And that's what we are. Now, on top of that, we have a constitution called the Torah. And, you know, you can either follow it or you can honor it in the breach. But in any case, being a Jew, even by halacha, just means to be a part of that family. And that's the difference between Christianity and Islam and every other religion and ism on earth on the one side and being Jewish on the other side.
But,
being Jewish means being part of a nation, being part of a tribe, not holding some particular belief system.
Phenomenal. Zev Magen is with us. What was the reaction when your first work on Lenin came out, when years ago you started approaching this topic, and obviously people not just in the Jewish world but other worlds as well got a hold of it? Was there a lot of resentment? Because obviously, again, you were going against one of the great heroes of the generation.
Well, yeah, I did get some hate mail from Beatles fans. It's true. But I can deal with that. I mean, they're not a particularly violent, type. It's not like
you would think not, right?
It's not like taking down Muhammad or something.
Yeah, it's not a Salman Rushdie situation.
Yeah, not at all. No. I'm not the only person for that. But the book pretty much uses John Lennon as I mentioned,
right,
as a kind of a scapegoat or a jumping off point, and it goes into a whole journey through Jewish history and Jewish philosophy and religion and try to figure out what we are. And all in all, it's as you saw in the early pages, I mean, I just had this traumatic experience many years ago when I went to visit some friends in L.A. And I met three Hare Krishnas in the airport way back when then, when they allowed them to be there. And they offered me these psychedelic Eastern religious texts in an accent that I knew too well, and immediately discovered that there were three Israelis from Ramat HaSharon right down the road from where I am now.
Right.
And it broke my heart. And each one of them had his own arguments, pretty erudite and pretty articulate arguments for why he had ditched being a Jew, and he was standing there in an airport on Friday morning wearing all this, you know, Hindu regalia and hawking Vedic texts to passers-by. And the book tries to deal with the arguments of each one of them. There were two guys and a girl. The girl was actually a first lieutenant in the Army, and she outranked all of us, and, you know, we talked about how it was in the mud, in the IDF, and we had all these reminiscences. And then it just hit me so hard. What the hell are you guys doing here? What brought this about? What kind of post-Zionism and post-Judaism that led you here? And what do your parents think right now? So the book is an attempt to deal with the questions that they raised about why a person in the modern world should affiliate with the Jewish people. Because it's a crazy concept.
You don't know where they are today, do you?
I don't know. I have a sneaking feeling that they're right back about 15 miles away from where I'm standing right now.
Boy, do I.
Back in Ramat HaSharon. I mean, I pray to God that that's true, and it happens a lot of times.
Boy, do I hope you're right.
Yeah.
We spoke about universalism. You also have a big chapter on a big part of the book, I said, on rationalism, which I think people can understand. I certainly can, why it's an important aspect of all this. But then you have one on the challenge of inertia. Is inertia a byproduct of all this? Is it something that arises because of the attitude from the prior philosophies and the schools of thought that you cite? What is the story with that?
Well, look, I mean, I think it's a natural human propensity to go with the flow and take the easiest path and follow the herd. But here in Israel, we have a new national anthem. Hatikva is out. The new national anthem is, and I've seen it ever since I got here 25 years ago, En Malasot, which means you can't really translate it exactly, but it means there's nothing to do about it.
Right.
And it's something you hear from Israelis on such a regular basis that you think it's some form of imprecation or davening or who knows what, constantly, in every case, when this is the way things are, this is the way things are going. The world is moving away from national particularism toward some kind of all-engulfing universalism, and who the hell are we to stand in the way? Let's just jump on the bandwagon, because there's no way we can stop it. And it's amazing for a people that for 3,000 or more years managed to maintain its fierce national individuality in the face of every single challenge of that type, for Israelis who pulled off the greatest miracle in modern history to now turn around and say, there's nothing to do about it. This is the way the world's going. We might as well just give up on the project. That's one of the most, awful things. Every argument that I advance in this book against universalism, against rationalism, for Jewish preferential love, tribalism, particularism, they can sit there and nod and nod and nod, and they'll say, yeah, you know what, that makes a lot of sense, and it even feels good. But guess what? In Malasot, there's nothing to do against, there's no way to go against the global flow.
Right.
Technological determinism is taking our kids away from us into these, screens that they carry around in their hands all day, which connect them to the rest of the world a lot more than they connect them to our own families and people. So you got all this stuff arrayed against us, and so that chapter is trying to remind us that we are the people that stand up and eat reality for breakfast and say, to hell with the way things are going, we're going the other way, we're swimming upstream, we're salmon, right? And we know, that we shouldn't let, for instance, technology lead us around by the nose. We don't have to now go off and just become like everyone else because, for instance, now it's possible to talk to everyone else in the world. So talk. Talk to everyone else in the world, but make sure that you've got a strong particularist base within your own religion and tribe, and then you can go talk to anybody you want.
And
you'll have what to share with them, for that matter. One of the things that I try to argue in the book is how awful it is that because of this push towards universalism, we now have nothing to share with one another anymore.
Yeah.
You go to some foreign country because you want to be a tourist and you want to be exposed to a culture you've never seen before. And instead, when you deplane, you get out and you see the same jeans on everybody's butt and you see the same advertisements and the same McDonald's. And you know, it's taking the world and making it into one big ugly soup.
And the U.S. is at the forefront of it. A lot of people like to blame Europe and other countries, but boy, do we have our part to play in this, don't we?
Well, but it's not the U.S.'s fault. I mean, the U.S. just produced what it produced. Some of it's fantastic and wonderful. Some of it's awful and horrible. But why in God's name does a country like Israel, with all and a people like the Jews, with all that we've achieved, not just in the past, but even just recently, how in God's name could we stand up and say, well, you know what, let's just forfeit all this, you know, self-respect and particularist culture. Let's just go off and import what everybody else has, especially the Americans.
Right.
You know, I mean, the word in Israel, in the great state of Israel, in the miraculous state of Israel, the word for something fantastic is America.
Oh, America.
America. That's how you say fantastic.
Right.
Now, I come from America, and America is fantastic in a lot of ways.
Where are you from, you know, in America?
Philadelphia, PA.
Philadelphia, PA. Zev Maygen, the book is called John Lennon and the Jews, A Philosophical Rampage. Now I really get the subtitle. John Lennon and the Jews, Zev Maygen, Toby Press. Our big thanks to our friends at Curran Publications. In our final half a minute, I have to ask you, and I'll explain why I'm asking you this question in a minute. Is frisbee golf a sport or not?
You're damn right it's a sport. It's one of the greatest sports ever invented. You know, if you want a Sunday afternoon activity that doesn't require forcing some poor guy to be your caddy and, you know, racking up incredible amounts of, you know, bills for all types of golf balls and who knows what, you get a frisbee and you go down to a frisbee golf course and just watch that baby sail, you know, toward the sunset, around the trees, over the river, until it clangs into the chains at the pole hole, and you'll know bliss.
And you'll know happiness. And of course, I asked that because you were the 1983 International Frisbee Golf Champion. Zev, thank you so much. Shana Tova, and good luck with the book.
Junior division.
I know,
champion.
Junior division.
I don't want there to be any misperceptions here.
Understood.
Shana Tova, Chatima Tova.
Tada Rabah. There he is, Zev Maygen. He's author of the book John Lennon and the Jews. Very interesting, to say the least. A Toby Press release. You can go to the Koren Publications website, KORENPUB.com, and avail yourself of this great brand new work. And I'm glad we had an opportunity to meet Zev Maygen during this segment here called Buy the Book, brought to you by Koren Publications right here at the Nachum Segal Network. I thank our friends at Koren and remind everybody that we have an amazing and incredible schedule, the Nachum Segal Network. Check out NachumSegal.com for the full schedule. And of course, the NSN app is an amazing way to tune in from around the world and be up to date in clear fashion on everything that's happening on a daily basis with us. Simply install the app. It's called NSN, the Nachum Segal Network app. And we will see you next time with yet another phenomenal author on Buy the Book right here at the Nachum Segal Network.